Welcome to the 113th JBST.com Smartcast, released for March 2013. This is the multi-sport podcast for triathletes, duathletes, sportive riders, road racers, time trialists, runners, mountain bikers, and fitness enthusiasts.
Whatever your distance and whatever your event, this podcast aims to make you smarter and faster.
Thank you for downloading this 113th episode. I'm Coach Joe Beer, and I'm joined once again by Southport Racing's Martin Crocker, just known affectionately as Crocker.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening.
Yes, very good. Right, so what's going on in the life of Crocker?
Nothing. Everything's good. Just wrapped up nice and warm. And working. That's it. So as good as it gets, pretty much.
Have you started racing yet?
Yeah, we started racing in November.
Yeah, well,
the winter series started and has finished, but the spring/summer starts in April.
So, yippee!
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Right, 50 episodes at iTunes.
50. Big 5-0.
Big 5-0. So there's a back catalogue there. We've had various emails and questions. We're going to go through those. There's five questions in today's episode. Also do some brief news, do some updates, and there's been a few tweets and a few bits of research that come in, so it's going to be packed to the hilt.
Packed to the rafters.
So brief news. Mountain bike legend Nick Craig is going to be on the Mallorca bike camp starting this weekend, and we're going to do a podcast with him. So if people want to ask questions of a man that has done much in mountain biking and cyclocross and stuff, get them in now, because I want to sit down with him and, you know, really
pick his brains.
Yeah, but find out, you know, about the man behind the legend.
Well,
because he's a legend. Nick Craig is a legend.
Well, he's been about kind of cyclocross and mountain biking for as long as I can. Was from as long as I can remember, magazine wise, picking up magazines.
Yeah. Okay, and mountain biking again comes up because there's been some more positive data on sodium phosphate loading with elite mountain bikers. So sometimes riders have thought that, oh, I'm really good, I maybe not get the benefits of sodium phosphate loading. And there's been some research that's not very, very recent, but has come out and is now visible, and very good effects on that. So if people are thinking about something that might add a few percent, sodium phosphate gets another tick. Very few research studies have showed that it doesn't work, so it might be worth investigating that. And another one, there's been a study published, I don't think it's out in the final format, but it's out in an initial version by Stirling University, showing that zone 3 high intensity work beats threshold sessions. So three lots of an hour threshold session done three times a week for 8 weeks. Okay, so what's that? 24 sessions. So 24 hours of threshold wasn't as effective as doing about 30 minutes of super high intensity stuff three times a week.
For 8 weeks.
That's hard work. Mm. Three super high intensity. You know, three lots of half an hour is really hard work. Not, you know, oh, it sort of hurt. They were at what people would equate to 10-mile time trial power for 4-minute efforts, six times that with only 2 minutes recovery.
So nice.
You know, but they got a 9% improvement, whereas the threshold people only got 2%. And as I've said to people, if you walked into a bank and said, do you want 2% or 9%? You'd say, I'll have the 9%,
please. Yeah. And the thing is I think if that kind of shows you that if you want to get there quicker than maybe zone 3, but you've got to realise, with big quick peaks comes
And it's still, what was it? It was 72 minutes done every week for 8 weeks. So that's still the best part of maybe 9 hours worth of zone 3.
Yeah.
But all the rest of it was zone 1. So it's important to make sure that, you know, if you do the really hard stuff, you've got to then correspondingly do the really easy stuff. Weren't doing three super high intensity sessions, and on top of that, trying to do, you know, another session out with the girls or boys that's a sort of hard session. You know, you've got to be super specific. And what I'll do is I'll stick a link up on the Twitter link so that people can actually click on that. It is available for purchase at the moment to see it, but basically the summary is go hard and you'll get the effects. But that was all done in 8 weeks, and you kind of imagine that's it. You're not going to keep going for another 8 weeks and get another 9% and another 9%. There's got to be a limit as to how far you can go.
Cool.
So do you want you do number two.
I'll do
in a second.
Two.
I'll do number one. This was a follow-up to the triathlon show. It was an email sent in by Simon Kidd, and Simon says, is there a copy of the presentation you did at the tri show? And I emailed him back, and this is also for other people. It's actually, if you go to jbst.com, at the very bottom of the page, there's a little number 120 in square brackets. Click on that, and you'll find it. So it's out of the way so that people that just randomly come across the site wouldn't look for it. But if you listen to the podcast or you came to the tri show and sat through one of the presentations, then that's where it is. Yep. And it's a PDF of the stuff, which includes actually, and this was a fluke because I didn't work it out, but it includes that Stirling study on how much they did and how much they got.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry,
yeah.
The Stirling study was a study on the intervals. So thank you, Simon. You kept me to my word because I said I'd put it there on the Monday morning, and sorry, it was Monday afternoon, but it was there.
That's all right. The second one here is from Duncan, I think it's Mullier, and it says, hi, Joe, in TTs...
Oh, and Martin.
That's all right, don't worry. That's all right, Duncan. And it says, hi, Joe, in TTs I do better on slower, harder days, a hilly course or a windy day, and I will be higher up the order. I use a power meter and ride to it. How can I increase my speed on fast days? I'm 39 seconds off of a sub 2010 and have a heart set on and has his heart set on breaking 20 minutes. Cheers, Duncan.
Well, I mean, he's going fast if he's getting near to 30 miles an hour average. It's funny, really, because if you think about it, If you're quite good on the, you know, the hilly, harder days, you should be able to produce the power because clearly other people on that day aren't. And maybe what you actually find is on the hilly, harder days, it's quite easy for people to there's various phrases, but blow their legs or blow their whatever by the fact that on the hard uphills, they go too hard, or into the wind, they go too hard, and then they feel like they're pushing hard through the rest of the ride, but they actually have done their legs in. And it's interesting, once you go to enough lactate level, you don't recover. We've all done it where you go too hard and you think, actually, I'm now pushing against myself and I'm not really getting that far. I'm going to have to back off. And the moment you back off, you've lost all of that supposed advantage of going over the threshold. So maybe the reason why you're good at it is the power meter that you use, Duncan, is going to mean he's better at pacing. Yeah. And if he's better at pacing, he doesn't perhaps go into the deficit that other people do on the hilly courses or on the hard days. Because hills and the wind, you have to push above the average, but you can't push too much above the average. I don't, you know, there's various calculations. It's something like 10% above what you aim to do for the rest of the ride, and there's brief bits where maybe you can go a little bit over that, but you can't suddenly do 500 watts up a hill and do it for more than, I don't know, 30 seconds and not find you get to the top and you're absolutely done in. So what would be the point then of going, oh, I'm knackered now?
I mean, I suppose it would it be another fact that maybe on the faster courses, he says, on how can he increase his speed on fast days? Mm. Do you think it might be a case of aerodynamics being more aero?
But he said even on wind. I mean, whether it's only hilly courses, I don't know enough about the detail there. But you're right. It might be that his power to weight means that hilly courses that also are on windy days are better for a lighter rider.
Yeah,
because he can go up the hills better. But maybe on a flat out and out, you know,
drag strip,
it's actually about having a very good low drag position and still being able to put the power out. I would doubt it's that he can't put the power out. That would be quite strange. If you can put the power out, it maybe is that he hasn't optimised his pacing on the fast days to realise, actually, there's bits of fast courses where you don't have to try so hard because there will bound to be bits where it might be a slight up to the turn, there might be a slight drag at points where you have to try harder. And I think on fast courses, people sometimes don't realise there's still harder bits.
And you cannot,
if you go too fast from the start, you might actually be failing at the point where you can lose time. Because the slower parts are where people lose time, not the fast bits. It's quite easy for a lot of people on some parts of the road to all be doing, you know, 25 to 30 something miles an hour, but then you hit the hard bits and some of those people will significantly slow down and the other people will slow down but less. And maybe he needs to work on his position so that he can get the power out but also carve through the air, because clearly if he's getting close to 30 miles an hour, he's at the cutting edge of the field. He's not somebody who's doing 30 minutes for 10 miles saying, how can I get quicker? So maybe, and this is the thing with very fast courses, is the aerodynamics starts to stack up to go. What did TSS say the other day? And that is the Simon Smart, by the way. Is it something like the drag is the change of the speed cubed, whatever it is? It gets harder and harder to go faster, which is why when you're up to a certain speed, you're actually not worth trying to push any harder, because if you know you're just about to hit a slight up or a headwind, that's the bit where you've got to push harder.
Yeah.
And what it might be is that he hasn't quite worked out the pacing of these faster courses, and that to go any quicker, he's going to have to invest in some pretty slick bits of equipment.
That's because the thing, isn't it?
Because the wattage to overcome and go another mile an hour faster is a massive increase. But there may be, and I think people don't realise, for the most part, if they're training quite well, yes, there are things, like we've said, you know, high-intensity training, there's phosphate loading, there's caffeine, there's various ways you can get the last few percentage points out. But there's more these days in drag reduction than there is in power gain.
Yeah.
So you can actually reduce your power, you can reduce the power on you and the bike much more than you're probably ever going to gain by training harder and harder and harder. If he's been doing it long enough that he's knocking on the 20 minute bit, then he's getting near to his ability to not put any more power in. Mm. And the fact he's got power, at least he can rate some rides, not on did I go as fast as the next person, but did I put out more power? But it is still the better riders are putting out very good power and they are extremely aerodynamic. Mm. And you can see some people that have spent a bit of money on their kit and their position and they can hold that position. They'll go faster than somebody that's been training like Billy-O, but they only get another 6 watts out. Well, that isn't enough. You can certainly get 6 watts off of most people's position and bike and stuff. So I would look really hard, Duncan, at your equipment and think, if you're pushing at 30 miles an hour, it really does start to become critical to have some pretty slick kit.
Yeah.
Because you're not somebody that's, as I say, doing just under 30 minutes and you're going, hold on a minute, you can maybe increase your training ability and so forth. You are probably up near, I'm guessing, the limit of what your power output is. Maybe there's more to come off the drag, and maybe there's some lessons in learning how to ride these faster courses.
That's the thing. And some days you just find that, you know, you turn up, you don't think it's going to be a particularly fast day, and it's not. And then you turn up other days thinking, well, I feel a bit tired. And then mysteriously you seem to get a floating day. So you just seem to fire along. And the problem is sometimes is you need all those circumstances to come together, you know, so your new kit, you know, the tire pressure's right. You know, you've got the right wheels for the conditions, for the course, you know, your pacing's good. Mm. And then you just find normally that you get, you know, within a few seconds is normally how it works.
Yeah.
But yeah, you just find that a bit of perseverance and then an honest look at your kit, thinking, well, you know, is that the best it can be? And I know it's expensive and I know a lot of guys are on budgets as well. So, you know, I think sometimes if you're honest to yourself and you want to beat this barrier, then I think you have to have a good look at your kit and just think, right, well, that could be improved.
And we were speaking before we started recording this, and all I'm going to say, because somebody slated us, is, okay, if you think you might be losing watts, go to Friction Facts, because something got flashed up just before we were about to record that shows a quite considerable change in friction in the system of the chain. I will say no more.
Yeah.
Okay. Is it friction-facts.com? There we go. So nobody can say we overdid the chains thing. No. There we go.
3 watts.
You just threw that number in there, just a random
watts.
Number.
No, it's in free, F-R-E.
Oh, free. I thought I said three.
No, not three.
Right, so on to Noel's question now. Noel Sutton, there was two parts. I will not read all of it because it's a lot of lines, but I'll try and pracy it. Okay, so once a week I do a long bike ride, couple of friends, nice sociable, no one racing, easy 3 hours or so. Thank God, Noel, firstly, that you've got mates and people that will respect one another to do that, because that's the point of some rides. And I know some people don't get that, but I'll just add that little asterisk in there. It's good to have that, because some people always have Mr. Competitive that turns up and turns it into a race. Other week, I had a poorly child, and so I couldn't ride as usual, but I did have two slots, one first thing, one later in the afternoon to get on the turbo. I ended up doing an hour and a half, relatively easy AM, and then an hour and a half with a few efforts in the PM. Does the combined 2.5 hours relate in any way to 3 hours that I would have done? What would have been better? Also, on a similar note, with the weather unpredictable, if snow and ice come down and I stay indoors to train, does 3 hours turbo compare to 3 hours outside? No, because firstly no. On the turbo, you aren't moving around like you do outside. You just don't. I think, and again, it's equipment and whether you've got it. But I think if you've got options indoors to actually do, if people have got them, I get them to do some on rollers, some on turbo, some on rollers. The rollers will probably be on their road bike and the turbo will probably be on their TT bike. So they can actually jump between them. And then you're not spending the same amount of time continuously on the same saddle position. Because out on the road, you think a road is flat. And then you ride indoors and you realise that's flat.
Yeah.
And you get real, really specific pressure points that are sore. And you have to get out the saddle and it changes how you ride. And so I think time indoors, if you're continuously pedalling, I would look at, if you can measure it, I'd look at normally on that 3 hour ride, how much time do you actually pedal?
Because
if you have a lot of times where, it is 3 hours, but there's always somebody that manages to, unhook their chain or get a punch or whatever, and you actually end up, 3 hours of it is 2 hours 40 riding and some 20 minutes faffing. But also, is there bits where, and you get this outside and you don't get it inside, where outside you're actually controlling the bike at speed downhill, but you're not doing much for your fitness, right? So there's differences that you can't really compare like for like.
You can't measure pretty much.
I mean, I would say the 2.5 hours would easily relate to 3 hours outdoors.
Yeah.
Without doubt. The thing is that outdoors, you know, unless you live literally on a billiard table, even outdoors in flat terrain, you'll have headwinds, you'll have slight subtle changes in the surface that you're riding on. You might even change where you're sat in the group, and you'll notice a big difference in power, in how you're sat, and in how actually the time flies. Indoors, it can be quite monotonous. And that's why people often put efforts in, is they just get bored.
Yeah.
And they think, oh, I suppose I better do an effort. Now, you can argue that you need to do some kind of efforts or accelerations indoors. So I'd rather people do, 8, 10, even 15 seconds accelerations every so often to actually have a burst of control power, not sprinting, not out the saddle, trying to break your frame, but just pushing a bit faster. So it breaks it up and it also spikes the power a little bit. Because outdoors, you don't ride absolutely flat in power terms. You have these slight ups and downs. But I don't think you should think that indoors
it's better.
A waste. No. Well, it's a waste of time or it's better. It's just riding.
Yeah. I mean, like Joe says, there's certain things that you can't measure. So, for instance, your bike handling, your rollers help with that. The rollers help with you keeping it nice and smooth. With you probably have to work your core a little bit more. But I would never, ever substitute, if there is a nice day, then go out and ride your bike. If you are pushed for time, then brilliant, get on your turbo. But Joe is right. Pretty much 3 hours of road riding is pretty much the equivalent of maybe being 2.5 hours on the turbo. But what will happen is if you keep using your turbo and your rollers, substituting that to go out, you'll get a specific workout. That's not a problem. But your friends won't bother phoning you anymore because you're not coming out, you're doing turboing. Your bike handling skills go to pot. So
unless you're on the rollers a lot.
Yeah, unless you use the rollers. So try not to substitute. I know with family commitments and, you know, if you've got a poorly child, then, you know, there's nothing you can do.
Well, you could put them in a trailer and tow them round.
Yeah, some form of resistance. But try not to substitute it for everyday kind of riding, everyday circumstances. You know, we've all got stories of where someone's tried to be pulled out, I've had to avoid a pothole, you know, and it's quite nice from the social side of it. But to split, I mean, I don't know what Joe's thoughts are, to split a training session in a day, you know, so you can have one in the morning and maybe do a session at night. I don't know whether that works out better, whether it fatigues you more or whether it gets your body used to maybe having to work a little bit harder through the day. I'm not sure.
Well, I think there's been some studies where twice a day training has a slightly different effect. I think one of the advantages of twice in a day is that as long as you're quick at changing and things are set up, it's probably easier to find a 1 to 1.5 hour block at two parts of the day than to say, I'm going to go off and do something for 3 hours. Well, I'll do the second part of what he said, because what he says is he's an age group triathlete. He works hard to get his workout time. If I've got a 3 hour block where I can train, I like to use all 3 hours. So if I've got to place my 3 hour zone one bike with training inside, I not only still want to get the full use of 3 hours, but I want to replicate the fitness from a 3 hour bike ride. Most advice, and I'd question most, but most advice is to get on the turbo or rollers for an hour and smash out some intervals. But surely this is completely counter to zone one training. And I can't replicate the fitness I would have gained by riding steady for much longer. You've mentioned before that any biking is turning the legs over and is therefore training. So is 3 hours steady on the turbo or rollers the next best thing? I realise that psychologically it might be easier to bury yourself naked in the snow and ice for 3 hours than ride inside. But assuming that mentally I can get through 3 hours on the turbo. And I think, you know, firstly, that most advice to get on the turbo and smash out is that people still, why they go out on the road sometimes and smash it out, or they do it indoors, is they will not believe that it's possible to finish some sessions, and I say some, not all, some sessions, and it be okay. They don't feel battered, they don't feel like they're in a bucket and absolutely exhausted. And if you do a split day, what you could perhaps do is think, well, perhaps Monday can be my recovery day. Well, I may as well do some endurance work on the Sunday morning, steady state, zone one. That will slightly fatigue the legs of glycogen, particularly with a 6 to 8 second acceleration, perhaps every 5 or 6 minutes, that'll just use some more glycogen up. Then when you get to the afternoon, do some specific interval work, proper hard work. And I know that's different to your 3 hours, but in effect, what you're doing is you're splitting up zone one and zone three. Yes, there'll be some zone one in the afternoon because you have to warm up, but then you could do some high intensity, you know, 4 minute intervals, 2 minutes off, 4 minutes on, 2 minutes off, and actually change the way you're training.
Yeah.
Because you could do the morning one on rollers on a road bike and have a different feel, the afternoon one in your tri position and really batter out the wattage. And therefore, none of it's junk, because one's meant to be in zone one and one's meant to be high intensity intervals. And I think you cannot condense training time into a tiny amount. There has to be time for base. And he's got 3 hours, so he may as well use it. So if you could, in effect, get a 2 hour morning ride and an hour very late on in the day, your body's warmer, you've perhaps, you know, as long as you don't get exhausted through the day, you can actually then do your interval training in the late afternoon or evening, and therefore you're getting two different types of training, because nobody has said that zone one is all you've got to do, and nobody says, unless you watch some of the documentaries, that you can do a few, you know, 30-second intervals a day and that's going to get you fit. If that was the case, the elites would not be doing 20, 30, up to 40 hours of training. So there's a certain amount and you've got that 3 hours, so use it, but maybe use it slightly differently. And I'd say that about group riding. There isn't a problem with saying we're going to do 2 hours steady and then we're going to do some intervals, or we're going to do, you know, an hour's ride out to a certain point, do some hard efforts up a perfect climb, and then do the rest of it easy. But what actually happens is when people have a plan is that somebody starts going fast from the beginning.
Yeah, and it all goes out the window.
It all goes out the window, and it starts being a whole threshold session, or certainly bouncing around in an unknown area. At least on the turbo, you could split it into base morning and intensity afternoon. And then you've actually ticked two boxes, because 2 hours base is enough for you for your you don't say which distance, or did you say, I can't remember whether you said you were necessarily Olympic distance.
It was just age group.
Just age group. So, you know, it depends. You might need that 3 hours as all one go because you're doing 70.3. Yeah. But if you're doing Olympic or sprint, that two-hour ride is a long enough ride. Mm. And then that pre-exhausts, but it doesn't pre-exhaust by you going as fast as possible. You're still in zone one, but you put in accelerations. That'll still slightly exhaust the glycogen. And there is some research suggesting that if you're slightly lower on glycogen when you do interval work, you gain a little bit more from that interval work. So you could even say that for the rest of Sunday, you don't go super high carbs. You kind of treat yourself to your more bacon and sausages breakfast after your ride in the morning, and at lunchtime you go for, you know, your cheese and your ham and stuff. You're actually deliberately trying to go for a lower carb intake. Yeah. And then in the evening do your intervals on a lower carb situation, and then you recover on Monday by saying, I've done a double session on the Sunday, some was endurance, some was high intensity, and actually that's two of the most important sessions of your biking done, so you can then concentrate on the important sessions for swim and run.
Yeah, definitely.
But it's always a difficult one, because I guess it's hard to know exactly what to do in those 3 hours, but it isn't, and you're right, and it's great that you've got a group of people around you that are quite prepared at times to go out and just ride.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's this creepage that happens that some people think, you know, if they can do a 3 hour ride and go a lot further, they'll get more fitness, or they'll cram a 3 hour ride into 2 hours 30 and just go faster. But actually, whatever zone one is, zone one. And This is the point that you see time and time again, is that when people draw that line of where the threshold of training at zone one is, it's because a physiological thing is happening there, not because people are weak willed or haven't got the ability to train harder. It's just, if you go beyond that point, you are now training harder than is typically called base work. And for some people, you've done this exercise, run around a track, Lanzarote, we've done it at Lanzarote, done it in Portugal, done it in the States, done it loads of places, where people will be lined up afterwards, and the ones that can run round a track nose breathing will be faster if they're doing a faster 10K. So we see somebody like Lee Pearcey, who's a top duathlete, run round in 5 minutes, and lo and behold, he can run 31 minutes for 10K.
Yeah.
Somebody at the other end of the spectrum that's running round in 10 minutes will be doing 60 minutes for 10K. So you can see that it does still, the basis of it can be measured even at an aerobic level.
Yeah.
And that's because you build the base and then you add the stuff on top. And I think with 3 hours, it's actually quite nice that he's not trying to condense it down. And if he does only get 2 hours, okay, do a 1 hour base ride in the morning and a 1 hour high intensity in the afternoon.
Yeah, that's the way. And I think with that as well, is you've got to look at it as a quality of life thing. Because especially if you've got a poorly person at home, then, you know, 3 hours out of your training schedule is not a massive amount, really, is it, to look after someone? So
no,
put everything in perspective.
But you know, knock some pocket money off.
Yeah, that's it. Wash cars.
Wash cars, and just say, do you realise what happened to me? But I mean, there are some people that are devastated by losing a session. It's like, look, don't cry over spilt milk. And it's such a good phrase. It's amazing that you can worry more about that lost time and think, you know what, things will get in the way. Whatever your plan is, there will be massive amounts of things that get in the way.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, what's it? Planning prevents piss poor performance.
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah. Sixth one. Because, you know, you have to have a plan. And if you've got a plan on the Sunday, do 2 hours in the morning, an hour in the afternoon, something goes wrong, you can't do your intervals in the afternoon. Okay, you've got 2 hours done in the morning. Oh, I've only got an hour in the morning. Okay, don't try and cram 2 hours into the morning ride. Just do an hour zone one. People think that junk training is going slower. It's not. Junk training is getting into zone two and pretending that you're still in zone one. Okay, that is the best way to impede your progress and actually to overtrain.
Yeah.
And people think junk is, oh, no, I can't do that stuff, it's too slow. Oh, really? You can't do that? Okay, well, go and find out what elite athletes and elite age groupers do and elite mountain bikers. They have to do a lot of training in zone one. And the interesting thing about that Stirling study was that it proved for people in the, they were about 8-9 hours a week riding, it was exactly the same theory as what happens with elites, roughly 80-20. Not, oh, well, no, it's only applicable to elites. No. Physiologically, our bodies are the same. They've just got bigger amounts and bigger capacities to train. So if you've got your week and I don't even think 80-20 works for a lot of people. I think 90-10, when you look at how much stress they've got in their life, the last thing they've got is enough free time and enough time to zone out to have enough mental ability to push for 20% of their week actually absorb it. That's the difference. Not being able to do it, but being able to do it repeatedly for a long period of time. And I know there are individual differences, but when I look at annual amounts of people's downloads, we rarely see 80-20. Most of the time, it's 90-10.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. And I think with what people have a tendency to do is then, it's like with high-intensity training, I think people tend to think, well, I need to be doing more of that stuff because that's what's going to make me, you know, that's what's going to make me fast. Whereas the truth of the matter is that's what makes you tired, that's what makes you ill, and that's what makes you miss races. So, but if you can get in with a good bunch of people, then, you can ride and no egos.
And you never know that, okay, you don't want to do that 2 hours base, an hour's real high intensity in the middle of winter. It's just ineffective and you're better just to probably do one session. But maybe as you get nearer to, and we're on the, you know, the verges of the season now, that you actually could get that afternoon evening session, even if there was just two or three of you that set up turbos in somebody's garage or a location very near to you, and you just went there and you did your turbo session together, because there's no substitute for kind of having misery with other people around you. It's why swim training is much better. Run training, bike training, when there's people around you. The problem with bike training, unless you're doing it with the right controlled environment, people just get spat out the back or just sort of not get lost, but they don't feel like they're doing it right. Whereas when you're on the turbo, you can all be doing the same thing, even though there might be big discrepancies of ability. But you all kind of suffer it together, and you've almost got a sense of, well, they'll do it right, I'll do it right.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, got one from Dave Timms, and he says, "Hi, Joe and Crocker." So he adds your name,
which
is very nice. And he says, "Enjoying the podcast, and I've been listening for a year or so. A time trial / triathlon question. How important is the nature of the front wheel in terms of aerodynamics? I see lots of disc wheels on the back, but a much broader selection of front wheels. I would have thought the front wheel was as important. Any thoughts?"
I mean, Joe will correct me at any point, I guess.
No, I'll just add what other people have told me, Crocker. I won't correct you.
I suppose it all depends. It depends on a lot of things. Obviously, number one, I suppose your budget. Number two, handling skills. Number three, weather conditions, which is probably linked to number two a bit. Yes, I suppose it's the forefront of your bike and it's the front end of your bike. So you think automatically it's cutting wind. But if you think at least 80% of the drag on the bike's going to be you, then, you know, I suppose it's a small price to pay to have a maybe not quite so deep sectioned, maybe, you know, a better aero helmet kind of goes the other way, I suppose. But I would say to, you know, I've ridden pretty much, you know, standard wheels, you know, 30 mils, 40 mils, 60s, 80s and 100s, you know, tri-spokes as well. So I suppose whatever you feel comfortable on, you know, one ride slightly harsher than the other. If you get one of a particular bunch in a crosswind, then they're absolute pigs. So you spend most of your time fighting the bike instead of concentrating on where you need to be going. I think if you get yourself a happy medium, something, you know, not everybody's got endless budget. So, you know, you can't have one of each depth, you know, depending on the wind conditions or depending on the course. So, you know, I think if you get something kind of a happy medium, you know, something you're happy handling in the winds, maybe isn't, you know, so massively expensive that, you know, there's a divorce or, you know, you're going to be homeless on your hands, then, you know, I would say, budget wise, get something you can afford, get something you know you can use for pretty much everything. You know, if money's no object, then yeah, go for it. You know, if you can get a deep section, you can handle one, then so be it. But you know, the course and weather and your bike handling skills kind of predict more what you can use.
Yeah.
But I mean, Joe will give us the kind of slightly more technical side to it. But I mean, having spoken to a few people and chatted and spoke about depths, a lot of guys on these big long drag strips tend to use a kind of intermediate depth anyway, just for the fact that the buffering effect that you get on kind of dual carriageways. So I reckon anything now between 30 to 60 mil is probably optimum, really, unless you're you know, the conditions predict that you can use like an 80 to 100. So, you know, and I think you can afford it, go for it. But I think a versatile wheel, you know, something you can control and handle, then anywhere between the 40 to 60 range, mil drop range will probably be the way to go, personally.
Okay, I'll start at a slightly different tangent to you. I think probably, Dave, there are far too many people that have got disc wheels on the back that don't need them.
Yes.
Okay, A, they're not riding fast enough. B, they're kind of getting attracted by the sexiness of it and don't really know the numbers behind how minimal it might be unless they're at the absolute cutting edge and there are far more important places. To give you some numbers, and you weren't there this year, Crocker, at Club
You
Santa.
Weren't there.
And
you
we
don't
missed
know.
You. We missed you. Simon Smart of Drag to Zero and Smart Aero Technology did a presentation, so it's not as though this was data that was restricted.
Shrouded in secrecy.
It was a picture of a rider, and it showed the areas of pressure on the rider and the respective amounts. And when it came to it, the rider was about 180 something watts. They were traveling at 25 miles an hour. This was at a 10 degree angle. So, you know, pretty average angle for the wind to be hitting the rider. The front wheel, which was an MV wheel, okay, wasn't that Simon's design, but that was only 6 watts. The rider was 180. The frame, which was a Scott, was around 30 odd watts. Mm-hmm. And so most of it was actually down to, the rider. And the disc did have, depended on the disc, but the disc did have, at that angle, very low drag, or in some cases actually negative drag. But the front wheel was still relatively small compared to the rider.
Yeah, yeah.
So firstly, position of the person's got to be right. And I think people buy a disc wheel thinking it's going to solve their issues.
That's right.
And yeah. It's not. It's a small amount. It's at the back of the bike. There's a lot of wind disturbance and stuff, and some of them are heavy. There are, you know, newer ones coming out that are very light, but they don't solve as many problems as they look. They look like they're a big solution because they're a big solid disc. And I think what you see is, yes, there's a broader spectrum of front wheels because people have got different abilities to handle them, and they do handle very differently. Different brands, different depths. Some brands you can get away with deeper and you still manage to hold them in a straight line. Others, over 50 mils or so, they're all over the place, and it's pointless being pushed side to side or having to ease off the power because you're absolutely scared witless by the fact you're getting pushed sideways. So I think there's several points. Firstly, the wheels are a comparatively small amount, but if you go through positioning, aero helmet, really good technical tight clothing that fits absolutely perfectly and can be, I think, the next area for a lot of people, certainly time trialists that can stay in that equipment for the whole race, that's the next place, is the drag on the rider, because you can drop that. And of this, I guess it was, what, something like 250 watts, 180 if it was coming from the rider. So you think, wow, okay, you can't make the rider any smaller, but you can make their body shape better. The helmet was relatively small in terms of the number of watts, but it was an aero helmet. So I think, you know, if somebody's riding, they've got a disc wheel but a vented helmet, well, there's a big mistake. You know, it's almost like a priority is firstly to get the rider into an aerodynamic position, also to look at the aero helmet, to look at the front wheel and the back wheel and look at the combination, but not get attracted to the fact that a disc is altogether going to be the fastest thing. Because there are deeper wheels now, especially some of the deeper ones that have been sort of tuned to be better than most discs, such as the 95 millimeter Envy, that's faster than most people's discs, yet it's considerably lighter. And what you've got to look at is triathletes don't tend to race on the same courses as time trialists.
No.
If you've got a really heavy bike, well, not really heavy bike, but you've got a disc, unless you're going so fast that disc is going to help you, it's actually not worth using it. And I think people get dragged into thinking it's going to be so much quicker, and possibly a bigger factor than both of the wheels is the tyres that you put on those wheels.
Yeah, I was going to say that.
Because the difference in drag between tyres is often greater than the difference in the actual wheels.
Yeah.
And so they don't look, I think they're the almost invisible part of going faster. You look at fast bikes, and there was one on the net at the hand-built bike show that got bike of the show, and it was a guy called English made this time trial bike, and it was just phenomenally built, absolutely phenomenal. But I noticed that on the front wheel he had Veloflex,
yeah,
and it's like, there we go. And he had an MV front wheel, so he went for the absolute most aerodynamic. I'm not sure the brand of the disc at the back, but he was also state champion, I think, very high in the US, so he probably was doing, you know, very high speed, so it made sense for him, yeah, to have a disc. But I think you can, and it's in triathlon as much as it is in time trialing, there are people being, you know, almost intoxicated by a disc wheel making them faster, and it probably won't. There's probably other areas to be looking at before you eventually say, I'm going so quick, the only place left for me to invest in is to take that deep rim wheel and to actually get a disc. But in some cases, actually be get that deep rimmed wheel and buy a better deep-rimmed wheel, not necessarily get intoxicated, yeah, by a disc.
And I think, kind of, to answer the question is, a front wheel will make a difference, but, you know, you've got to think of the shoes that you put on it as well, so the tyres that go on it. And that's another factor to put into your budget as, yeah, well, because, you know, that could be... There's no point in having the world's best wheel and then putting a really, really poor tire on it.
Yeah.
There's just no point.
Yeah.
So what you're better off doing is maybe trim the fat off your budget by going, right, well, I'm going to have to save 50, 60 quid. You know, back.
That's pounds for people.
Sorry, yeah, 50, 60 pounds.
Pounds.
You know, to get yourself that decent tire. So maybe I would say, personally, the most usable wheel is somewhere in the range of 40 to 60 on the front. If you're just going to be using it for TT racing, then maybe, and the skill factor, your honest handling skill will allow you to have a slightly bigger wheel, and you're not too bothered about getting buffeted around,
yeah,
with side winds, with crosswinds, then yeah, go for a bigger drop or a deeper drop, sorry. But if you're a triathlete or you're doing the longer distance stuff, then anywhere between 40 and 60 is perfect for you to be able to use. But just use a bit of common sense when, yeah, it comes to you rock up on race day and go, it's blowing, you know, 20, 25, 30 mile an hour winds. Is there any point in using that deep section wheel when you're going to, yeah, be fighting it all the way around?
Yeah. And also, I think the thing with the disc is that it only helps you on that occasion. Like most race kit, it only helps you on the occasions that you, yeah, use it. The amount that some people spend on a disc, which you'll be able to say what they retail, some of the brands retail.
Oh, anything, but up to $2,500.
Yeah, $2,500.
$2,500.
That money, for most people, if they think they're going that fast, I should sure as hell hope that they've got a power hub or power rotor cranks or, yeah, SRM or whatever. Because if you think you're going that fast, you should definitely be riding on power. And if you're not going that fast, then don't get distracted by the disc. Get yourself the entry level power meter and start getting every session right.
Yeah.
Because the disc will only help you on the occasions that you're riding fast enough to be gaining from that sort of effect. There's far too many other bits on the bike that make drag and that could be optimised than actually looking at it. But it is that big, sexy-looking piece of carbon that people...
We've all done it.
And they like the noise going... you know, and they kind of go, oh, yeah, but I'm sure I ride faster. And it's like, wow. Now, that's the power of a placebo effect. But it's actually, are you doing it properly and sitting down rationally and going, right, can I train better? Can I do other things on the bike? And if you went through... probably, I'd say, no less than 20 factors at the end of that one, or number 20 would be get a disc wheel.
Yeah.
But it would have a lot of other spending and investments in your equipment that came before that.
Yeah.
But of course, a lot of people, they've seen faster people on disc wheels and think they must be fast because they're using a disc wheel. They don't realise they're doing perhaps 360 to 400 watts for 10 miles. That's why they're going fast. And yes, they're trimming the watts off, but there's plenty of people that are going fast that are on deep rimmed wheels,
yeah,
and not on discs.
That's it.
Yeah.
So, but I would, for the time being, if your budget doesn't allow, overlook the fact that you've got deep section wheels and have a look at getting tyres sorted, decent tyres,
yeah,
sorted.
Decent tyres. What's your choice of tyre, Martin? If you could have the perfect tyre?
I am still a fan of the ones that you introduced me to, Joseph, which was the Vittoria.
And what did I purchase from your very shop this day?
Corsa Evo CXs.
There we go, in 23 mils.
That's it.
There we go. Put in my, and I don't get anything from Vittoria. I just think they have superb tyres. Yeah. There are different versions now, and it's starting to get a bit difficult.
Sweet Lord.
There's so many versions of CS Chrono and CS Slick, is there?
Yeah, they do an AquaGuard as well, and they actually do a Vittoria Corsa.
Right.
That's it. So they do the Vittoria Corsa Evo CX.
Yeah.
And they do the Vittoria Corsa.
Yeah.
And they do a CS.
Yeah.
A CX.
Yeah.
And there was another one, a TS, I think there was as well.
I'm sure there's a Slick. There's loads of them, and I don't know the differences enough, but the CX is probably the best.
It's the best publicised.
And why I bought them today for that bike was because I'd ridden one on the rear wheel for the majority of the winter, and you saw eventually it went.
Yeah.
But that was a lot of riding in it, so they aren't as fragile as people make out. Okay, if you ride in the gutter, you'll get punches on anything.
Yeah.
But they aren't as fragile as people think. And yes, they wouldn't be the normal choice of riding tower, but I thought, well, put your money where your mouth is. Ride them and see whether they just splinter. And they don't.
No, they don't. Brilliant.
And they're a nice tyre. So there we go. Get off tyres quick, we'll get a bad
email.
Yeah,
I know, and changing tyres again.
Andrew Dawson, who sent us this, says, I'm sure we haven't done this one before. Hi, Joe and Crocker. Again, he remembered your name, that's good. I'm hoping to ride one of the biggest sportives in the Alps this year, and I've been following your advice and getting in lots of base miles. However, what sort of intervals would be best to add into my training? There seems to be a lot of different views, 20-minute time trial or short 2 or 3 minute intervals flat out, 2 times 20 minutes, etc. Thanks, Andrew Dawson, who's got a funny mobile phone number, which is 000000000000. Well, anybody could accidentally phone him up, couldn't they?
That's it. Yeah, easily pushed in your pocket.
I'll start then. I think it is worth with sportif riding, doing base miles, doing strength work as well, where you actually pick some climbs, you know, your longer climbs that you've got available, and being over-geared and actually working at the sort of 60-65 revs to get strength that you're not going to be forced, hopefully, into doing that slower cadence in that bigger gear in the race, but it makes you stronger.
Mm.
So you've got the base miles, the strength miles, and actually, yeah, to do some hard work. Of all the interval stuff, and I've used this winter to really look at intervals, and not because I think sometimes people think I'm the king of base training and I don't like hard intervals.
Yeah.
I've already done some interval training this year just to kind of remind.
I am outraged.
Just to remind myself, and in Lanzarote did a hard CP20 test and stuff. So I'm not scared of going hard, but I think you've got to know how hard it should be and how often. For a sportive rider, I think still it probably makes sense to be in the proven area, which would be something around a 4 to perhaps 6 minute interval. So, but go hard, you know, give it your best 4 to 6 minutes. Be looking at 87 to 90% of max heart rate. There's been research done that over 90% max heart rate doesn't really gain any more. So, you know, pushing yourself really hard, you're probably just not going to do them for very long.
Yeah,
and I don't think you need to do many. I think if you did, you know, 4 lots of 5 minutes, that'd still be 20 minutes of hard threshold work. It's still way above what you're going to be doing when you do a sportif. I mean, sportif, if you've still got some juice left in the tank to push the last climb, brilliant. But it's more about being energy efficient. But if you do these hard intervals, you do gain a bit more power, so your overall cruise speed goes up a little
bit. That's right. Yeah.
You do get a bit of adversity, so you're not the sportive rider that just goes out and rides lots of long miles and sometimes does the odd dig but doesn't really ever really push themselves. They're not used to getting into hardship and then digging themselves out of it. They're only used to kind of pushing a little bit near to threshold. We're on about a 6 minute climb and going really hard, almost trying to race everyone, but not, you know, not doing the first one and thinking, crikey, I'm trying to do 4 of those. Oh, I'm done in 1. You still got to do 4 good ones, 4 lots of 5 minutes, and still be ready to ride back home.
Yeah.
And pick a, you know, pick a quiet hill, a pretty constant, I don't know, 5%, 6%, 7% hill, something you can get a tempo up. You don't want to be trying to go up something where you're out the saddle just trying to keep your nose on the front wheel. You know, you want something where you can push constantly against an incline, But the moment you let up, you'd be slowing down. So it makes you push harder. Yeah. And that's the challenge with the sportives. It's not, I mean, going downhill, be within your limits. Don't end up one of the plonkers that goes home in an ambulance. Oh, yeah. But it's the uphills where if you can have gained more power, you can climb more efficiently. On the day, if you've got 20 minutes left and you're near the end, you can do it hard then. But most of it will be about energy conservation. And you learn on really hard threshold stuff, how too hard is, therefore you're not going to go anywhere near that on race day. But you just sense that you've got a different gear. So when you're doing most of your climbs just into the 80-85% heart rate zone when you have to on the sportive day, you've been up to 87-90%. So you still know your body's got a bit more left.
Yeah, it's a difficult one, I think, with sportives, because you kind of... It's really difficult, I think, for guys that are relatively new at kind of the sporty scene, how to level out their ride, you know, how not to go too hard, how to kind of measure the fact they want to get a gold standard. So, you know, maybe it's 4.5 hours or 5.5 hours. Mm. It's really difficult to measure. I find probably the sportif more daunting a thought of a kind of a race plan than anything else. Because, you know, with mountain biking, you kind of, you know how many laps you've got to do. You're in a pack, so you know kind of, you know, who's up front, how far away or how far behind they are. Whereas with a sportif, it's almost you against the clock, you know, depending on how fast you want to go.
Yeah.
But do you think the guys that do sportifs, their fitness... basically is the big telling sign of whether, like you said, I think your idea is to be as efficient as possible and trying to stave off the kind of the inevitable feeling of tiredness. So, you know, even kind of interval sessions almost need to be at that point where you kind of, you almost want to jack it in, but you just know that you have to keep going, don't you?
It's still the hardest session of the week, but... it teaches somebody that they can push harder. They haven't just got one speed. And then it lets them off the hook to then say, I know my rest of my rides don't have to be necessarily as hilly. We have different hills in the UK to people that go, you know, they go abroad and they say, wow, it was 5% for 20 kilometres. And it was perfect. And I didn't go anaerobic. I just sat there and got a tempo. Here, we suddenly get 10% for 200 metres and then flattens off. And it's a very different type of riding. But it's also that, although he's asked about, you know, adding in the kind of intervals on top of the base miles, it's also having a different kind of ride where, ironically... it is going to get you into zone two, but you try and pace your feeding and say, right, I'm going to go out for 3 hours and I'm going to push it on a bit. I know it's going to be out of the classic zone place, but I'm just going to try and see how much I can feed at that sort of pace. Because you do find yourself in sporties. I mean, if you go into it and you just want to get round, well, yeah, it actually don't even need to do interval work. Just be prepared to stop and have lunch somewhere and trickle round. But when people get competitive, they say, how do I make a difference? It isn't necessarily to do lots and lots more riding. It's certainly to add some intervals on. It's to learn how to feed. If you know how to feed and you know it's going to take you 7 hours, you've just got to be prepared to say, how am I going to carry that amount, or how am I going to get that, or what's available? And then learn to be able to pace yourself based on how much you're taking in. Because you've still only got the same, let's say, 2,000 calories of carbs in your body when you start, but you've got to eke it out over 7 hours, not just a 2.5 hour weekend ride. So you've got to be able to feed constantly, carry whatever you can or pick it up because you know it's going to be there, and at the same time know where that perfect pacing point is to go up the climbs and not think, oh, I can just about survive it and go down the other side. Because if you do some of them with maybe three Cat 1 or similar type climbs, you're going to make the first one and feel strong. The second one, you're really not going to enjoy it. And the last one, you're going to be off and walking, because they will be 10, 20 or more kilometres long. So you've got to be able to, look at intervals as the icing on the cake, but it's as important to know how to feed during longer rides. And that would be the base rides. You can still, at a base ride, be, you know, in the 70-80% area, where you've still got to feed. If you're doing 3 or 4 hours, you need to still feed or you're going to go pop.
It does fascinate me, thinking about sporties, because I kind of put myself into that position. Where you think, well, I'm going to be out here for 7, maybe 8 hours. And like you said, you've got 3 or 4, 5%, 8% climbs for, you know, 15, 20K. So like you said, I don't think the intervals are quite so important, but trying to do a bit of race prep, so a bit of racing reenactment. So, yeah. You know, you're thinking, right, I'm going for a 5-hour ride today, for instance, you know, maybe 4 hours, 5 hours. I'm going to go quite hard, you know, for the first 2 hours. I'm going to see how my feeding is. Mm. And then maybe, you know, back it down a little bit for the middle duration. Mm-hmm. And on the final one, maybe you take in a local hill where you think, oh God, you know, I'd eat this at the end of a good ride. And of course, chuck yourself up it. You don't need to see how fast you can go up it, but you just need to see as if your body is adapted to what you've taken in, you know, how tired you feel. So I think it is probably more of a case of maybe thinking about the intervals later on, but, you know, first of all, just get your little bits knitted together nicely. So if you've done a few sports...
I like that phrase. Yeah. Use UK ones. UK ones to do stuff. But people, every time I've been with people and we've done a sportif, they've just been flabbergasted at how long the climbs are. You show them the climbs, and I don't think they take it in, but they say, what, the last one is going to be 20 kilometres. Yes, it will be 20 kilometres uphill. That isn't like, you know, false flats and you notice, oh, actually, we only went uphill for five. No, it will be actually more than that, because they often, particularly when you do like the Étape de Tour, they don't even include some of the foothill bits. So you start going up and you think, This is a bit early, isn't it? And then you realise that they don't count it till you get to the actual proper slopes. And I think most people really need to do one of the European races, or sporties rather, to just get an idea of what it's like. Because you have to just think, right, I'm sitting in now and I'm going to be on the bike for X minutes going uphill. And one of the really good things is to do what's called like a VAM test, which is find the longest hill that you can that's consistent. It's got to be like a 6-8% hill. And ride it like at the top of your zone one. So ride it 80% of max. And just see over that period of time how many metres you can climb. And then you work out metres per hour. So you say, OK, at the top of zone one, I could climb, let's say, 800 metres per hour. Well, if you've got a climb and it says ascent gained is 1,000 meters, you think, wow, I do 800 meters in an hour. This is 1,000 meters of vertical ascent. My God, that's going to take me an hour and a quarter.
Yeah.
And that's assuming that you can still deliver the same amount that you could when you did this fresh day thing. That's people's VAM drops as they get tired. But just to get an idea of how many meters ascending you can do per hour, because somebody that's, you know, not very fit would probably be down at, quite literally, the 500 area. Elites can be as high as 1,500. And very, very fit sportive riders, you know, are up around the 1,000 area. But you just then get a sense, if you don't look at a climb and even worry about how long it is, it's how much do you gain? Because it might be long, but going up very, very constantly at 5%. Or it might be quite steep, but it's at 10%. Well, you could gain the same amount, but it would be in a different way.
Yeah,
and the moment you realise how many metres per hour you can climb, you look at climbs and go, wow. And people look at the last climb and afterwards say, yeah, I'd worked out beforehand it was going to take me 2 hours, but I thought I must be wrong. But you know what? It took me over 2 hours to climb it.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, you've got to realise that these things are, they're measurable beforehand, but you've got to put them into your head as to normally thinking, have you got, you know, a 12 or 13 mile climb? No, most people haven't got a 12 or 13 mile climb or near them. But that's how long you're going to be going for. So you've got to get your pacing. You've got to get your feeding right. But also, the biggest factor in sport is you and the bike have got to be as light as possible, because you're like the grand tour riders. You've got to be able to see that going uphill is the biggest factor. We can all fall downhill at various speeds.
Yeah.
On the flat, you can sit in with the group and save energy. But when you go uphill, it's your power and the weight of you and the bike. So the very good sportive riders are the lighter riders. And most people that are getting into it at a fitness level don't realise how much they're losing out. Not because they haven't really got the legs, because some of them have.
Yeah,
it's that they're a lot heavier than other riders, and therefore they just lose out on the vertical bits. And they say, people just ride away from me. I don't know why. And it's because it's power to weight.
Yeah.
So intervals might spur your body into losing a bit more weight because you start pushing it harder. But I think you've got to get into these things. And then people literally spend the rest of their cycling life saying, every year I do, you know, the Étape de Tour, I do something somewhere in Spain or Italy or whatever. And that's what they do. They train in the winter, they do some UK sporties, and then they'll do one big European one where there might be 10,000 people doing it.
Yeah. It'll be a brilliant event no matter what, but
yeah.
I think kind of your kind of high intensity sessions are like Joe said, the icing on the cake. Try and knit together all the other little bits and bobs first. You know, are you as light as you could be? Is the bike as light as you could be? You know, it could be. I'm not saying go out there and buy a, you know, sub 14 pound road bike and stick some even lighter wheels on it, but you know, just try and work out your feeding strategy. Try it in the UK. All right, the weather conditions more than likely are going to be slightly different. You know, if it's hot, have you compensated for that? You know, if it's going to be cold, have you compensated for that? You know, there's a lot of things you've got.
So he's, you know, he's again, he's asking the right question, and I think it is short intervals that help. Yeah. But there's loads of other factors, and I think if you get distracted by thinking that, you know, a 20-minute time trial is completely different to doing, say, a hill climb, where you actually sat on your bike like you would be going up the Alps. We think, yeah, I'm going to just choose 7% climbs because that's what I'm going to be riding, and actually get fit in that way. There's people that could sit hunched over on a TT bike. You get them onto those sort of climbs and they just can't do it. They're not used to that sustained, efficient riding. And sporties have grown without anybody really seeing it come in, and they've become very popular in the UK and all over Europe. And yet, there are a multitude of different things. They can be fairly flat, fairly fast, you know, almost like big chain gangs, or they can be these, you know, tests of misery that people literally. Yeah, I've seen people on a group that took about 4 years ago, and you know, people afterwards were, it was like something out of MASH. I mean, they were shell-shocked in how hard it was. And one guy I passed on the last climb, and he was just, his face was sunken and he was really in pieces. And up to then he was, yeah, you know, brash and bravado about how it was going to be great. And I think it the great thing about sportives is you can take it to a point where they really are demanding.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Then you sit down about a week to 10 days later and you watch the tour riders ride that stage, and you are befuddled at how fast they can do it.
Yeah.
And they did something the day before and they're back on the day after, and you've done it for one day. The day before, you hardly touched your bike. You just rode it around and checked the gears. The day after, you're in the coach on the way home, and it puts it into perspective.
That's the thing. And,
yeah.
And like you said, you know, you can do all, you know, you might have a climb around your house that's 10K long over, you know, 5%, then brilliant. Doing that every day, you know, from now until when you race is fine. But if you haven't got the energy in the body to be able to push those pedals round, then it ain't really going to help you, unfortunately.
Right, so we will jump on to now doing some very quick tweets and some short fire answer to them, so that we've got lots of different bits in it. So there was one from Neil Scholes. I know Neil, and he says, I said something about second rule of Fit Club is never get cold, you know, before training, racing, etc. And he said, and I get his point, he said, is there not good science around pre-cooling? Pre-cooling is a bit different. Pre-cooling is when you're in a hot environment and you warm up, and at the same time you try and keep the body temperature down, and therefore you don't start the event already with heat build-up. So you see various, you know, teams and even runners with ice packs on and hands with ice cubes in and so forth. But It might work, and there was a cooling.
And this leads me on to my next piece of paper.
There's something about cooling that can help recovery. So it's different type of cooling. Cooling after exercise can help recovery. So it's not saying don't get cold after exercise. It's different to taking heat away from the body and then wrapping up warm. As we do in training camps, you sit, you know, you stand in the swimming pool, you get the heat out of your body that you've built up, but then you go back and you dress up and you have your shower, but you've just got rid of the initial heat, okay? And the same as before, we're not saying don't pre-cool, but most people don't face that situation. Most people aren't in a situation where, like, you see the Tour de France riders, the Tour of Spain riders and so on, that, you know, they're warming up, but it's the middle of the day. It may well be, you know, 25 to 30 degrees. So they've got to warm up and stay cool. Most of the time, people doing time trials, triathlons in the UK, we don't get that often. And even if we do, it's a very difficult thing for people to actually enact. They often say, oh, I haven't really got time to warm up. So they don't even really have a warm up. So they warm up in the race. And if they do, to then have an ice vest or to think about it in that way. I mean, I always like, you know, particularly when you're doing perhaps something single sport, having a cold bottle of water and tipping it over your head just before you start. Because it's amazing how if you have been warming up, you get quite hot. And one of the first places you notice heat buildup is in your head.
Yeah.
And that's where you notice, start thinking, oh, it's getting hot. If you can keep your head cool, you can actually push through the heat. It's when people get a hot head and they start listening to it and then they start going, oh, my head's a bit hot. Oh, I think it's hot. And I think cooling your head down, you often see riders tipping it on their head, you know, putting you know, cold water on their body. So, yeah, there is science around pre-cooling. But I was saying don't get cold before sessions. So don't, you know, hang around in hardly any clothes in a UK conditions for most training.
Yeah.
Now, how many times last summer did you actually have such hot conditions you were having to, you know, drink iced water and stuff? Not many.
Not.
I can't remember.
I was just sat there thinking, no.
Another tweet, which was... From Rich Carter, who says, this may be a silly question, but how do I know what and how to use each supplement in the 220 article? Well, read the article. He asked about it because I tweeted about it as if I was able to write in however many words you get in Twitter,
that's right, yeah,
that you could write it all. Read that. That is the most up-to-date. It depends, again, like the disc wheel, aero helmet, tyres on your bike thing. Supplements are the icing on the cake. Don't sort of think that, you know, everyone's got to take creatine or carnitine or sodium phosphate or nitrate or whatever. There's so many things, and a lot of people don't realise their diet could be improved or other things could be improved, and they see something that claims a magic percentage and they'll jump on it. But from what was last year but is now in been enacted this year, the European Food Standards Agency has made it that you cannot have these ludicrous claims. So you'll look at the labels on most products this year and you'll think, wow, they've kind of spruced the label up.
Down.
Oh, and they've spruced the label up and they've spruced it up. They've all got to have very, very concise claims and ingredients lists and so on. So they cannot claim something that isn't true. And therefore, some supplements that people have thought were worth taking are absolutely bogus. Others might work, but don't forget the obvious things, which is, you know, carbohydrate and hydration in sessions. Looking at the obvious sort of recovery drinks when you need them.
Yeah.
And then if anything else is applicable, then you have to start looking at what's going to be the most cost benefit for you.
I think that's the thing as well with that is... you used to be able to make any claims that you wanted and it didn't have to be substantiated. But now the European Food Agency say that, you know, it has to be supported with creditable scientific evidence. And I think
a lot of creditable. I mean, you're talking thousands of people must have been.
It doesn't have to go through something daft like 10 agencies, 10 different testing agencies.
Don't know.
For it to be verified. So think that eating kind of gels whilst on the bike is going to make you fitter and faster than really work like that, unfortunately. So and you do fall into the traps of it. It's quite easy for us to talk about training and speed and bikes and everything kind of working with them every day. But you still have to go and ride your bike.
Oh, yeah.
It doesn't make you fast talking about it. So,
But it's nice to get things concise. Which brings me on to, this is another one.
Handily brings me on to
Well, because it relates to it, is that, again, Neil Scholes, he actually...
Hang on a minute, have you actually taken a snapshot of the screen with that? Oh, right,
yeah, I did, I took a snapshot of the screen on my phone, dragged them into our... Oh, no, it's quite long-winded. But it means I've got all six on one page.
No, I'll give you that one.
Save the paper.
I'll give you
that. Save the paper. And he... It was a retweet, but I'll say it anyway. And I said, come on, people, get the numbers right. 500 millilitres of beetroot juice for 6 days is a proven protocol. And it was because I'd seen in a magazine somebody saying 200 millilitres for 2 weeks. That's absolutely...
rubbish.
Balderdash. Balderdash, that's the word, yeah. Mm. And just out was another study.
Oh, which handily takes me onto another piece of paper. This is going like clockwork, Dave.
Is it?
You've impressed me
the
tonight.
Effects of nitrate on power duration relationship for severe intensity exercise. I love it because you look at me just go, what? Basically, using, and they did beetroot juice, but they did 250 mils twice a day. Well, two 250s are 500, so there we go. It isn't in full report form yet. So I don't know how many days, but I'm assuming because of one of the names that... No, actually, two of the names that have in it have already done it for 6 days when they've done their protocols. I think it is 6 days. Right. But they found that when the people were tested after having the beetroot, and some people had beetroot that had the nitrate taken out, that the people that had the beetroot, the proper stuff, when they did interval efforts very hard, they were between 11 and 17% faster. Sorry, not faster, I'll correct myself. They lasted for 11 to 17% longer right. at efforts that were between the top of zone 2 and peak power. So the basically all the way through zone 3, they were somewhere between 11 and 17% better lasting.
Yes.
On just, you know, beetroot juice. So there is something in beetroot juice, and when I'd seen it said totally wrong, it was like, well, come on, it's not like it's a trade secret. We know what it is, but when people start putting their own spin on it, no, because there's absolutely no proof of that. It's actually a waste of money if you're just having 200 millilitres. So maybe get it right and say 500 millilitres is the proven amount. Somebody might try higher, but it seems to work on 500, so why do any more?
Yeah, fair dues. Have you got any more mysterious pieces of paper that are going to pop out?
Do you want, there was another one, just a last minute one, which was to do with triathletes and cycling on the bike and running performance afterwards. This is the abstract format of it, but they looked at riding for an hour and seeing how it affected a 10K run. Or 9.3K as they put it. They'd run a run on its own as well to see the comparative difference. But what they found was when the power was much more variable, ranging from 40% up to 140%, so there's much more variation in power, they were 40-odd seconds slower over the 9.3K. So I guess that's getting you almost up to 50 seconds over 10K, okay? So variable power affected them something around about maybe 6 to 8 seconds per mile slower. I mean, 50 seconds, you look at 50 seconds, a lot of people say, oh, God, if I was 50 seconds quicker, I'd have got third in my age group or I'd have beaten person X. And so there was higher blood lactate when they did the variable training, okay? Sorry, the variable riding. So variable riding made their body, well, clearly, if you go 140% of your maximum power, you go into lactate buildup. Well, in a time trial, in a triathlon, you aren't meant to be racing to T2. You're yeah. meant to be under control. And it was at the best, well, the standard pacing was at 65% of peak power. And somebody did send me a text and say, oh, that doesn't seem to be that high. Actually, 65% peak power is maybe a tad low. It might be nearer to 70, but it's not much over 70. If it is, somebody's getting very close to their normal 25 mile, because 25 mile time trials are typically done at about 75% of peak power. So you'd imagine close to 10% drop when somebody's got to run 10K. Yeah.
So effectively, what this, in layman's terms, this sheet is telling you, that if you can regulate the power that you put out in the cycling leg of your triathlon,
yeah,
then it's more beneficial for your run.
Yes.
Or it's less, what can you say? So your run is, it doesn't suffer quite so much.
Yeah, yeah.
With your varied power.
I mean, one of the difficult things to translate it into real world is it would be quite hard to hold 65% of peak power, even 70% all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
But you can go out of that range and only use just enough to be out of that range. It's clearly not beneficial to hammer every hill, because if you hammer a hill too hard, you will build up lactate. Yeah. Nobody can do that and say, oh no, I don't build up lactate. Well, you must do. You just don't realise that's what's happening. And every time you do that, you're actually slowing yourself up. You cannot repeatedly bash yourself into zone 3 and not realise there are going to be repercussions.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there was higher lactate when people had that variable power, all because they were going into areas where they weren't as aerobic. So it does make more sense to be controlled.
Yeah, consistent.
Because you're not trying to race to T2. They've still had, their minimum run time was sort of 35 minutes. So you know, it's not like you can fake 35 minutes if your legs have already gone pop. And they were, you know, well-trained, almost 5 litres VO2 max. So they were, you know, well-trained triathletes. But it would suggest that using power, as was concluded, highly variable power is likely to impair 10K triathlon run performance, which is what you'd imagine. But I think some people would believe that they can just, you know, as I saw the other day, somebody was on about smashing the bike. No, you can't. That's the ego cyclist that goes tanking by and will tell you all about their cycle time, but won't tell you they got passed by a load of runners on the run.
That's the thing.
And I think, you know, it is getting your pacing right, but with power meters, it makes sense to be able to pace and then to be able to say that, no, you didn't get from A to B as fast as possible. And I think a great... I think if you took that upper distance, you went to 70.3, you'd see something that works multiple times, which is people that go into it with an idea of power don't get to T2 as fast as they could have, but they have great runs.
Yeah.
And they sort of say, yeah, each race we can maybe just nudge it up, maybe 5 to 10 watts and see where the tipping point is. But having a really strong cyclist last year come in to do triathlon 70.3 and look at the bike leg, and I said, this is the wattage. And he said, yeah, everyone that knows me said, oh, you're going to really hammer the bike. And he didn't say anything because he knew he wasn't going to. But if you're aerodynamic, you will get a lot out of that wattage anyway.
Yeah.
It, just by going up another 20 watts won't make you that much quicker, but it'll certainly do your legs in. And that's what people don't realise. The amount you're adding is relatively small. These riders, I don't know, were say at, they were probably working at about, say, 230, 240 watts. But if somebody rode at 260, 270, they wouldn't be so much faster, but they would be impeded. And there must be a sweet spot. And I don't think it's quite 65% for Olympic distance. Yeah. It's maybe a little bit higher. But for 70.3, it's even more important because you are going on the bike for 2.5 hours plus.
Yeah.
So you could blow up on the bike alone, let alone blowing up on the run. And pacing is just about having an idea of what percentage you've got to hold and stick there and keep the feeding going. Because you will get to the end of the bike and think, I could have raced that, but it's not a bike race.
Yeah,
it's a triathlon.
That's the thing. Yeah, yeah.
It's a triathlon. And people get carried away and they see somebody going by. But if that person's got, you know, higher wattage, better equipment, and is pacing themselves, they might just be on the same game plan, but just going quicker.
It's always going to happen.
Yeah.
It's always going to happen.
Yeah.
But what used to make me chuckle a little bit is when guys used to come in off the bike and you look at them and you think, good Lord, they look absolutely shattered. And then 3 or 4 minutes later, you got another guy comes in who looks relatively calm. And you can almost guarantee that on the run...
Yeah.
This guy's just going to get into his stride, off he's going to go, and come the last 5K, if he's got anything left, can go, well, actually, I might have a dig here, and then off you go. But you'll guarantee the guy that's come off the bike looking like death is just wishing it was over, straight from kind of 5K in, just going, oh, I wish this was over, just because of... And it's such a simple thing, pacing, really, because you know how many watts you've got to play with. You know, I suppose, again, if you're fortunate with a power meter, you know how many watts you've got to play with, and that's where you're going to be.
Yeah, yeah.
So
and know that that gets you to T2 at whatever rate that gets you to T2.
Yeah, yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah. Somebody cannot, and you kind of see that in I guess a viewpoint of the pros is, you know, they're racing in a draft situation, but nobody suddenly rides off the front and comes in 5 minutes quicker.
No, that's it.
So you think, well, they must be riding just at the point where they know that they can still run, but nobody is prepared to actually push it so fast that they get in a minute early, only to get outrun by 2 minutes.
2 minutes.
Actually. And the same is happening at age group level, just the numbers are different. And even more so, if you're riding legally, then you're riding against the wind on your own.
Yeah.
So your aerodynamics is vastly more important than whether you can go harder than somebody else. Your percentage might be higher, but it certainly wouldn't be that Olympic distance people are riding at 75% of peak power, because that is a time trialist's effort, 75% of peak power. So it's got to be 70% or less. So even if this 65 was slightly easier, well, they still ran 34, 35 minutes. And I know they were good athletes, but it you know, it wasn't... I think there would be a limit of, at the very most, 70%.
Yeah.
So there's still only a 5% difference there. And that might be, you know, the difference of experience and the difference of going back and retesting people and saying, OK, does this still work if we say 70% constant power? The hard thing in real life is to be able to hold 70% constant power, because that means on some bits you're backing off and on other beats you're trying to get up the gears to keep the power going. And yes, there's going to be differences, but it doesn't want to be a massive difference.
No, no.
But you should feel like you are constant. There's nothing worse than people, like you see them in midway in triathlons, hammering up a hill looking like they're Cavendish in the last finishing straight, and you think, what's that going to achieve? What, you're going to pass that person, are you? Wow, well done.
But the good thing is with reports that you've got like that and tests that they're doing, they are becoming far more specific, if you know what I mean.
Yeah,
you know, they're looking at those little things that make a difference. So yeah, good.
Okay, one hour 20 almost.
Any more pieces of paper that
No. I cannot give you any more. You'll get too excited. You'll be jumping up and down and swiveling around in the chair.
Spinning around.
So thank you again for the questions that came in. Contact us. Go to jbst.com and click on the contact or through the Twitter. But I'm not going to reply to Twitter and use it as a conversational thing because it starts going bonkers. So just send the questions and I'll take a snapshot of them. Newsletter going out soon. I was hoping that Martin was going to give us a special Southport Racing bargain.
Well, I wasn't. I've had a little chat with obviously the powers that be.
The powers that be.
I mean, as it stands at the minute, there's nothing that I would say spectacular. But we still have, I'm trying to think, like, I think you tweeted that we still have a plasma left.
Yeah.
So that's one, well, that's it.
And how much is that? £600 off?
I think so, yeah, it's something like that, isn't it? But also, just as a kind of an interesting thing is all the bikes that we get in now with kind of DI2 or UI2, we are doing like an add-on upgrade. Obviously for a few quid more, we're doing time trial shifters on aero bars.
Yeah.
So like with drop handlebars, so clip-ons. Yeah,
clip-ons with drop handlebars.
So yeah, we're doing those. A couple of bikes have gone out with them and they seem to be quite successful considering you can just, at the minute it's a bit awkward to just unplug the TT shifters out because you have to back unwrap the bar tape effectively. You know, yeah. The shifters stay in situ. They stay on the end of the bars, but you know, you just unplug the shifter from the main drop handlebar shifter.
Well, great way though, because you got changing on the hoods as well as on the bar ends.
That's right,
so you can change from whatever position you want.
Yeah, and I can see there being a little kind of inline plug-in adapter soon where they're going to be just joined at the end of the aero bars underneath the drop handlebars just so you can flick them
where you
them
have
out
your little control unit.
Yeah, so and they'll split those. So that's quite a nice interesting little upgrade that we've started to do.
Pimp my bike.
Yeah, that's it pretty much. So.
Okay. Right, so any others, put on your Twitter feed.
Yeah,
and
then
the lovely listeners can see those come up on their phones and pads and computers and the like. So Twitter feed, insider news, athlete achievement, stuff between the podcasts. As I've put, not for questions, so I'm trying not to use it as a two-way medium. I'd rather those come in via email. Facebook page for questions and discussions. Add your reviews at iTunes, please. There was a Sir Skinny of Saunton who sent one recently. We know who that is. Thank you very much once again, Martin, for your invaluable input, humour and beauty.
Mm. I thank the Lord we are on in audio.
Yes. So we are approaching the season. Most people are starting to kick the cobwebs out and start to go a bit faster. So train smart, race fast and have fun.
Adios.
Test, test, test. 1, 2, 3.
Test, test.
Don't get so close.
I like it.
Let me see if I can get close. Test, test. Okay, so I think we need to speak at a uniform level, like we would normally.
Okay.
Yeah, and probably keep the same distance as best we can. You're quite red there.
I'm hot as hell. Yeah. Windburn, that is.
Is it?
Yeah.